Okay, let's give this a shot. Okay, let's give this a shot. I'm a little under the weather. It's almost New Year's Eve, and I wanted to get one more podcast out there before the year's end. However, I'm in pretty rough shape, so I apologize if you hear sniffling and coughing along the way. This isn't a New Year's podcast per se, but if you're interested in something closer to that, check out the last podcast episode or last few articles about the Twilight Zone New Year's Eve marathon. This is more observational, and it might be a mess, but these are just some things that I've observed looking at where the right seems to be going and some gaps with how some, and you know, everything has a qualifier, some people on the left, and trying to identify the left is a thesis on its own, but just generally speaking, left of center. So I'll talk about liberals versus the left and stuff, but how sometimes the right gets misinterpreted or how things might be approached in different ways. So a lot of people on the right, just like the left, there's a far right and everything in between, but a lot of people are openly talking about 2026, not just as another election cycle or leading up to maybe the next presidential election, but as a moment where there might be some power fractures and contested authority, and that normal political rules may not hold. What I've noticed is a widening gap between how the right is actually thinking and emotionally preparing for another phase. That's kind of a loose generality, depending on what part of the right you're talking about. But also that many liberals and leftists are responding as if we were talking to ourselves or in an older political moment. So laying things out kind of step by step can, in and of itself, sound like institutional or expert language. And that's kind of something I wanted to begin with. Essentially, this podcast already doesn't apply to most on the left. People would have clicked out of this. Because just even laying the groundwork for what it is I'm going to talk about is old hat now, right? That tone can feel foreign or even suspicious. That doesn't mean that the right lacks intelligence or strategy or that they're right. Correct. It means that for many, they don't organize politics through explanation and structure like the left. They organize it ironically, right, through mood, repetition, grievance, and also through that repetition, a sense of inevitability. So despite the slogans of, you know, facts or feelings, their message is driven far more by emotional coherence than by any type of factual persuasion or structural evaluation. And the problem isn't only that the right is extreme and that extremism is becoming more mainstream. It's that the way in which extremism is being reframed on the right is that of not extreme at all, right? The Overton window has moved, and that's really moderation or realism, and of course common sense appealing to the middle. And positions that would have sounded radical are now presented as practical responses. They're not the ones who are broken and messed up. It's the world that's such. And meanwhile, many of the responses coming from especially liberals, but even some maybe more institutional leftists are, they aren't landing like they used to. And it's not because they're wrong, but it's because they're aimed at a political environment, again, that doesn't really exist. There's a common, especially I think liberal idea that the right will be discredited, and by being discredited, it'll fail. There's still an assumption that if the right fails to govern, right, doesn't deliver materially, or is exposed through fact checking, and those are all kind of, you know, different things, right? A material analysis of the right which can exist is different than reacting to a fact check or failing to govern. But regardless, there's still this assumption that if any of these happens, that support will erode, and that assumption isn't necessarily correct. The right is already adapted to failure, and that adaption is one of the most important things I feel like to understand, not only now but in the coming year, because you know, with those failures, there are going to be power grabs in different wings and individuals of the right, and it might seem like it's chaotic and it's just failure everywhere. But I think we have to reinterpret what failure might mean to someone left of center. In earlier political frameworks, you know, failure would weaken a movement, obviously, right? Missed promises damages credibility, coalitions fracture, accountability existed. But for some, that logic has flipped. And I'm going to use the different ways to describe this, like inversion or flipped throughout. But today, failure can be processed as proof, right? Proof that institutions won't allow real change. And I feel like I'm going to say this many different ways, so bear with me. But it's proof that quote-unquote elites are sabotaging outcomes, right? It's proof that institutions, courts, media, bureaucracies are aligned to block disruption. And it's proof that democracy itself is compromised. Once failure is understood in that way, which might sound familiar to some, especially in the further left, but this is not a horseshoe argument. But you know, once that failure is understood in that way, a lot changes. And that is a difference between maybe liberals and leftists, that the acceptance of that. Losing a policy fight doesn't weaken the movement for the right. It can strengthen its story. And story is another important key that's going to kind of exist throughout this, about how rigged the system is. Obstacles can become confirmation. The inability to deliver on electoral promises can become evidence that delivery just won't be allowed by whomever. And that's when the conspiracies come in. And at that point, and very importantly, elections stop resolving disputes and courts stop settling legitimacy, right? The norms in general, democratic norms, stop disciplining any type of behavior. Every failed attempt deepens the belief that ordinary channels are just exhausted. And that's a psychological shift, especially I think for liberals and progressives. When failure becomes proof, that means that escalation starts to feel rational. Sticking to the rules is naive. Restraint can appear like complicity. And this is the moment where exception logic, breaking the rules, overriding norms, using extraordinary measures, emergency measures, starts to feel reasonable rather than radical. It's where these discussions can now exist in the mainstream, right? And in your uncle's Facebook feed as opposed to Stormfront boards. So politics stops being about governing well and becomes about demonstrating that governance itself is impossible under the current order. And that current order can mean a few different things we'll talk about later, but it's one of the keys to differentiating the sense of that across the political spectrum. And that's why many standard tools just don't work, right? Labeling something racist or fascist can be accurate, but it can still backfire, or at least not change an opinion, because it triggers a tone, and the tone battles and persecution narratives the right already expects and uses. So fact-checking doesn't disrupt a worldview built from the concept of institutional betrayal and decline anyway. Appeals to democratic norms fall flat when legitimacy of democratic institutions is already rejected. And now this isn't true across all of the right, of course, but this is something that used to be on the fringes and still is, but that's become very much more accepted. And in a way, MAGA almost represents that phase of, okay, they were the outsiders and now, you know, they have to govern. And of course they're doing it very poorly. And I'm not saying that, you know, critiques should stop. I'm saying that they just mismatch the political terrain sometimes. And they assume that there's some type of baseline, whether it's ethical or moral or trust, accountability, and institutional authority, that's already eroded for large parts of the right. And without recognizing that shift, responses keep missing what's actually happening and why the right remains resilient, even in failure. And I guess that's the point of saying all this. It's, I do feel like for people across the center left all the way to the far left, that people are kind of exacerbated seeing this slow motion car wreck happening and saying, how is this still valid? How do these people have power? So that's one thing. Another thing that I've been thinking about is the role of fringe figures. And this is something that, you know, I've struggled with too a little bit. Fringe figures, I believe, shouldn't be treated as irrelevant. I think too many times that they're kind of mocked or joked about or you know, marginalized, sometimes in ways, you know, very similar to how far right media people will harass people or mock them or bully them. And it isn't, I'm saying we should, you know, you have to worry about their feelings, but I think more to the point, I don't think that they should be treated as irrelevant just because they lack basic respectability or when we're listening to them, the things that they're saying are outrageous. They often articulate beneath all the BS, right? Which is the edgelord stuff. This is what gets them their audience. But, you know, they often articulate the next phase of a movement earlier because they're not constrained by coalition maintenance or media access or plausible deniability. They can say the quiet parts out loud and they can say them early and they can say them first. They can acknowledge even failure sooner. They test new explanations before those explanations are cleaned up and moved into the mainstream language. So, and I'm not going to platform anything but one kind of essay, I suppose, more like diatribe, that was a post-Trump prediction, right? Mattered not because of its author, but that I read, but because it revealed an adaptation underway inside the movement, right? Trump's objective failure to govern, to deliver material outcomes, was widely acknowledged in this, you know, right-wing piece. And it also acknowledged kind of institutional collapse. And it prompted a reframing. The movement behind this stopped asking whether Trump had failed and started asking how failure itself could be reinterpreted so the movement could survive. And in this reframing, failure was no longer evidence of incompetence. It kind of goes back to what was initially stated. It's evidence of obstruction, non-delivery, right, of electoral promises, for instance. Treated as proof that entrenched institutions, courts, bureaucracies, et cetera, must have intervened to block the change, right? It's not that Republicans are just a disaster and they can't govern. The system, not the leader, becomes the culprit. And this is why, you know, you have a lot of people, liberals, progressives, people on the left saying this is like a cult because it is very figure, you know, centric. But kind of similar in that way, without actually saying that, because I think there's problems with that blanket statement, but there is a shared kind of concept of failure becoming confirmation. And I think to understand everything that follows, the rhetoric, the coalitions, the contradictions, you have to start with that baseline assumption now running through much of the right, right? The assumption that legitimacy is already gone, and so failure doesn't actually mean failure. If anything, it can double down by saying that, well, it's because the institutions are no longer legitimate, which in extension can, of course, easily lead into mainstreaming of more radical ideas of the exception or the emergency. And it's not merely, you know, threatened, this legitimacy. It's not something that can be restored, which is different from a lot of liberals and progressive concepts, right? Through better messaging or cleaner procedures. And this is a divergence, right? About how the folks that I just mentioned, liberals, maybe some institutional left, are operating. And in those frameworks, the legitimacy is still assumed. It's these idiotic people that are mucking up the system, right? When institutions fail or behave badly, the instinct is to reform, to repair that process. And this is nothing new to a lot of people listening to this podcast, but forms of institutional mistrust exist in the left, but they operate very differently, and it leads to different conclusions. On the right, across the far right, dissident right, increasingly mainstream conservative discourse, the starting point is institutions are presumed to lie by default, but of course it goes in a very different direction. So this does not require belief in every specific allegation or conspiracy. And conspiracy is really key in all this. And it's different because for a lot, not all, but for much of the right, there's just a lack of structural analysis, right? What matters is that distrust comes first, and evidence can then fit around that narrative. Evidence does not correct distrust. It accumulates with inside of it, and it can be twisted and distorted to fit the story. So distrust is the baseline rather than the conclusion. And once distrust becomes that baseline, that moral burden flips. And I've said this already a few different ways. I'm going to keep saying it in a few different ways, but this is where breaking norms no longer requires justification. And by that, I'm not talking about moral or ethical, because that's already out the window. What I mean by that is legal justification. Now, having precedence is good, and that's why a lot of things that we're seeing happening are happening. Expansion of terms like the term terrorist, for example, going from an armed insurgent from a non-state entity to moving into drug cartels, to drug runners, to people filming ICE when they're conducting arrests, right? So all of that helps, but bypassing institutions no longer requires an explanation or an apology. So, you know, those extraordinary measures are framed as reasonable acts of self-defense rather than dangerous escalations in the mind of someone thinking like this, who might even be moderate, right? The concept of this being really about, again, self-defense. It's not a dangerous escalation. It's just responding to realism. And this is also why I think Europe plays such a central role in right-wing discourse now, or it already has, but it feels like in 2026, it's definitely going to. So Europe functions kind of simultaneously as a warning, a proof of concept, and a rehearsal space. And countries like Germany, France, Italy, Hungary are presented as evidence that liberal democracy cannot protect itself, that elites collude to block patriotic parties, right, censorship, and that containment mechanisms such as firewalls represent tyranny rather than democratic institutions protecting themselves, regardless of critiques about them. So when figures like J.D. Vance attack European firewalls, or when American conservatives defend parties like AfD as victims of repression, they are not primarily talking about Germany, right? They're practicing an argument meant for the United States. And again, once that legitimacy is assumed to be broken, traditional political planning stops making sense. Policy platforms, legislative roadmaps, governance programs depend on the belief that these institutions are going to function. And if that's our, if we're post that, if that's already collapsed, and the absence of detailed policy is not confusion or incompetence within this view, but an adaptation to a political environment where success through normal channels is assumed to be impossible. So instead of planning for governance, the right shifts towards building narratives, right? And this is not just messaging or slogans, but it's a durable system for interpreting events and absorbing losses, like mentioned before, and maintaining coherence, even when no material things are delivered. There's no legislation you can point at to say this has really benefited me in a great way. And in this framework, politics is no longer about that, right? It's about shaping how people understand why these laws never arrive, or why promises stall, or why failure should be read as confirmation rather than defeat. So blocked policies, court interventions, electoral losses, you know, to liberals, these look like successes, and they are in some material instances, right? It's preventing movement and action, but emotionally and ideologically, it's not perceived that way from the right. And this is how people are, you know, talking past each other, right? And not understanding each other. I'm not saying there should be a kumbaya. It's more about analysis and trying to get a clear understanding of where camps are and how people are thinking and feeling. They reinforce the right that to believe that the institutions are being hostile by design. And this goes back years and years and years and years and years. But arguments first articulated openly at the edges. And again, this is why I think fringe people are more important than they're sometimes given credit for being, are stripped of their most explicit phrasing and then recoded. And that recoding is important. Again, this is not necessarily anything new either. It's just escalated of being recoded as common sense and realism. And especially with social media, and people leading platforms, people, you know, like Tucker Carlson and people leading cable to stream. If you're on social media, if you're on a platform like X, or, you know, even now more so Facebook, you know, with changes that have been made, it begins to seem like this is the majority or this is inevitable. And the conclusion that nothing works is normalized without being presented as radical. Or allowing disappointment to become proof of clarity rather than a reason to disengage or criticize these leaders for not doing what, you know, for not making things better for the people who voted for them. And alongside this narrative infrastructure is that expectation of exceptional power that's been normalized. And I think that this is really important. Over time, emergency language has expanded, right? It's expanded from foreign threats, maybe 9/11, to domestic targets. Border enforcement has become a spectacle, and extraordinary measures have been discussed casually and repeatedly. I mean, National Guard being deployed to cities, right? So this has not produced a single plan or a prediction of like a dictatorship, but it has made emergency logic emotionally acceptable because of that repetition. For many supporters on the right, exceptional power is no longer frightening. It's actually what they want. It feels justified if, in their view, ordinary politics continues to fail them. So most people do not experience this in abstract terms, right? They encounter politics through things, feelings, frustration, resentment, fear. The ideological work, of course, happens above them. It's where politicians or media figures organize those feelings into stories and narratives that explain what's wrong and who's responsible, as opposed to structural critique like you get on the left. And at the mass level, this appears as, you know, decadence politics, the sense that society is corrupted or inverted. At the elite level, it appears as managed exception, where leaders normalize the idea that ordinary rules can no longer solve the problem and extraordinary measures may be necessary. And I think, you know, importantly, the system does not depend on success. It depends on signals. Even actions that are blocked, reversed, or symbolic still demonstrate intent and alignment. court losses, institutional resistance to not demobilize these supporters, like they might say progressives. They reinforce the core narrative that the system is rigged and disruption is being deliberately prevented. And in the structure, loss does not weaken the movement, it confirms it. So this produces a powerful feedback loop. American conservatives cite, you know, Europe again as evidence of collapse and awakening at the same time. European far-right actors cite American elites and platforms as proof of legitimacy, and media and institutional actors echo both. The result is a shared sense of, I've said inevitability a few times, maybe a shared sense of history itself that is moving in a direction. And of course, some people literally believe that. I mean, you know, we don't have to go down those, but there are parts of the left, the kind of more obscure left, but traditionalist left that would actually see these historical movements, maybe even in a semi-dialectical way, or if you want to talk about like Bannon and stuff like Kali Yuga and traditionalism and Evola and all that. So this is not most of the right, but there is, I think, with the onslaught and the repetition, a sense of things moving in one direction. And this can be dangerous if it is accepted by even progressives, but also the left too, because it feels like you're on the outside looking in and nothing that you can do matters. And that's not true. That's exactly what they want you to think and feel. So from the outside, this can look incoherent, right? Because positions shift, messages are contradicting each other, promises happen and nothing comes of them, or they're really vague. But from the inside, the coherence is maintained at the level that matters most: identity, orientation, and moral permission. Those are three things I kind of identified. And this is why the movement, again, can survive with abject failure. When material gains don't arrive, things aren't better, right? Symbolic domination can fill that gap. Humiliation of you know, some elites, outrage from enemies, right? Rage baiting. The visible institutional discomfort becomes substitutes for any policy success. So I think once that's understood, many familiar critiques stop landing or making sense. Operating from within that paradigm, I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying you should, but it's understanding, right? Pointing out contradictions is not destabilizing narrative designed in many ways to metabolize them. It's a closed system in many ways. Exposing non-delivery, it doesn't discredit anything, right? So this is why there are so few white papers. The plan is not what to pass, right? The plan is how to read the world when nothing passes, and how to prepare people to accept exceptional power when normal channels are then declared exhausted. And that's frightening and important. Up to this point, I think I've described maybe like a shared orientation of actors, but that doesn't mean that there's like a coalition that's unified, because it isn't. And if there's any right-wing person listening to this, they, up to this point, they'd probably be, you know, laughing about how out of touch I am. The internal factors are real. So they're real and they matter. But what's important is understanding where the splits actually are and why they don't stop the movement from functioning. The key point is that these splits or the split isn't between reasonable moderates and crazy extremists, which is something that I feel especially liberals kind of cling to. And it isn't mainly about beliefs or policy goals, right? That may be even something that progressives can, you know, talk about. It's about how people imagine breaking the rules and how far they think they should go. That's the unifying through line. And all these groups agree that normal politics aren't working. Where they differ is what to do about that. The first group, and these are groups, you know, this is kind of ham-fisted, it's generalizing, I know, but the first group sees emergency power mostly as a threat and a signal, right? Not something they actually want to do. They for them, the value is in keeping the idea of exception alive. They want leaders to look like they're willing to break the rules without actually doing it. And this creates pressure, right? It scares institutions. It energizes supporters, and it allows every limit on power to be framed as oppression. They can talk in calm, respectable language. They can frame things in security, sovereignty, freedom of speech, democratic self-defense. They avoid saying things like suspend rights, but they constantly imply that rights might need to be overridden in special cases. And their goal is not like a dramatic revolution. It's that permanent tension, a state where institutions are always on the defensive and authority feels conditional because of that. And then there's the second group, the group that wants something much more direct, right? For them, emergency power isn't symbolic. It's the goal. It's the solution, right? They believe the system is fundamentally unjust and can't be fixed. What that end looks like is a book. There's too many differences, but that shared through line is important, right? The concept that normal rules are not safeguards. They're obstacles. So breaking them isn't tragic or regrettable. It's necessary and overdue. And this is how people who have different points of view can kind of converge on that through line or that concept. And this is where you see open talk, right, about mass detention, public deportations, suspending habeas corpus, which might have been something that you would see in the Daily Stormer, you know, like a few years ago. But now you have people like Stephen Miller talking about that, right? Treating protest as dissent and criminal support for enemies, right? So Gorka's comments about aiding and abetting immigrants. These measures aren't framed as last resorts. They're framed as long delayed corrections that will finally bring clarity, but I think importantly in this, I guess you would call it epistemology, order, right? Hierarchy. And what they want is finality, a clean break that resolves a sense of permanent injustice. And then you have this third group. And notice that the second group isn't, it's not just people on blogs, you know, it's not just people hanging out in image board rooms, but okay. Then you have another group that's kind of both, right? They don't want endless emergency rule, but they do want one decisive moment. And maybe some of those people just mentioned fit in here, but one show of force, one purge or reckoning that proves the rules can be broken when it matters. And after that, they believe things can maybe not go back to normal, but become normal, a better normal, and one that has been reset through the exception. And I think what's important with this is understanding that all of them fall on the same spectrum. And it kind of, you know, pushes back against the idea or the concept of words have no meaning anymore, right? So this is, if you call someone on the right a fascist, they're going to laugh at you and say, you don't know what that means. But all of these concepts, right, they're not economic, not policy, not even necessarily how governments organize, but the narrative all fall on the spectrum of a fascist rebirth myth. And in all of them, there's some form of purging that's necessary, followed by some form of purification. And that rupture and what those things mean are just different, but they're different in extremes, not necessarily very different in content. So what matters is that these positions are not mutually exclusive in practice. They can coexist because they operate on different, I guess you could say something like time horizons. So the translation wing keeps that coalition socially visible, right? The revolutionary or rupture wing keeps it emotionally energized, and the in-between wing keeps hope alive that something real will finally happen. And from the outside, it looks like a total incoherent disaster. But from the inside, it's a division of labor, right? And honestly, they would disagree with that, but I don't care. So at this point, it's reasonable to ask a simple question. If this movement is so is confident, right, if it feels inevitable, why does it keep losing support in the polls? And this is a reality. So right now, Trump is underwater, even in friendly environments. He's down in pro-Republican polling. He's down in Fox's polling. I'm thinking Rasmussen for Republican, Fox, and he's way worse when you get to things like Reuters or Gallup. And that matters, but not in the way I think a lot of people assume, because polling weakness does not automatically signal retreat or moderation. And inside of this way of viewing things, it changes how the outcome is interpreted, right? A movement that expects to win easily invests in persuasion. A movement that expects a narrow loss and invests maybe in fraud narratives for cover. But a movement that anticipates a clear loss does something different. It begins preparing its audience to see the outcome itself as illegitimate. And this is, of course, not something that's new, but it's something that needs to be discussed given the polling situation for Trump. This is where polling weakness can become a strategically useful rather than damaging. So low approval is not interpreted as rejection. It can be spun as or truly believed as evidence of manipulation, media saturation, institutional bias, cultural capture by the left, right? The worse the numbers look, the easier it is to argue that the system is aligned against the people, right? It's institutional leads versus the organic, whatever, MAGA populists. So the argument is that the goal isn't always to stop an election result outright or block a new government from taking office on paper. Instead, the goal can also be to make sure that real authority never settles with whomever takes power after. So even if a transition happens, right, new officials are sworn in, the new government governs in hostile environments from that first day. Its legitimacy is constantly questioned. Every action is treated as suspect. Every decision is framed as extreme, not even partisanship, but fitting into a very myriad of conspiracies. And in that situation, the institutions that are pushing back against this or actually generating something new in a positive sense, positive not meaning necessarily good, but in creating something new, courts aren't seen as neutral arbitrators. They're portrayed as political weapons. Law enforcement isn't viewed as legitimate authority. And again, there's some overlap here, but I don't want to do that. This is in a different sense, right? I'm thinking more about during COVID lockdowns, right, and concepts about that. It's described as occupation or repression. Obeying laws and rulings stops feeling like a civic obligation and starts feeling like a personal choice based on loyalty, not because of structural analysis of injustice or systemic issues, right? But I'll talk about a little bit more of that later. But the key point is that this doesn't require a coup. It doesn't mean that January 6th had to be successful or that another one would happen to be successful. It doesn't need an insurrection act or martial law or a single dramatic break necessarily. There doesn't need to be tanks in the streets or generals in the streets, even though we see National Guard deployed. It can work gradually through repetition. And that's not something I've seen a lot. That's not something I've seen discussed much. I think outrage at what's happening has been visible. I mean, and I've written about that. A neighborhood that I used to live in was stormed in a military style by ICE with tanks and flashbang grenades, and it's crazy. There's a school on that street, but you know that spectacle doesn't necessarily lead up to a Turner Diaries and or some type of break. It could also be something that's slow. It's a slow roll that works through repetition that then begins to feel like inevitability or history. And in short, it's about making governance possible, right? Only for us. And illegitimate for them, regardless of the formal outcomes. And that can have staying power because you don't need to have electoral successes. You don't need to implement policy. You don't need to have great foreign policy. This can just become a worldview, right? That's accepted. And The goal doesn't even necessarily need to be inevitability. It can just be availability, right? People are being taught that extraordinary measures are legitimate responses to ordinary politics, even if those measures are never formally invoked. So while there can be structural analysis tied to this, and what there's more of on the right is narrative or story, moving from rightful deference to victimization, resentment, anger, disenfranchisement. Whether those are factual or valid or not, people can feel like they've lost things. They can feel politics becomes a way to explain identity and loss. And these pressures don't automatically always produce extremism or that rupture events. Lots of people experience the same things and don't radicalize or don't manifest it in the rupture. But what matters is whether there's a ready-made story available to provide an arc and meaning if there are losses that will continue the movement, continue things grinding forward. And I think that this is where the inversion comes in. Reactionary politics in some cases works by just flipping things. It's not really that complicated. It can be complicated, but it can also just be flipping liberal language back on itself, right? It takes concepts like representation, identity, advocacy, and just reverses them. It's something I think a lot of like Nick Fuentes people in the world would do, or maybe people that listen to him. If it's acceptable to organize around identity for some groups, why isn't it acceptable for others, for instance, right? The argument, of course, deliberately removes all the structural context of history and power, but it replaces them with a surface level symmetry, one that happens. And once that happens, we have backlash being reframed as fairness, restriction being reframed as equality, and punishment reframed as justice. And I said a lot to now, but in the very beginning, I said I'm gonna say a lot. I'm gonna use the same phrase over and over again, or display the same thing, inversion. And it's very much just what we see here too. It's not complex, and that's why it works, right? It doesn't require deep knowledge or commitment. It feels obvious, intuitive, emotionally satisfying. It turns resentment into something that feels principled, even when it's grounded, even if it isn't really grounded in real world analysis. But when reactionary arguments rely on inversion, flipping liberal language about identity, rights, or fairness, the instinctive response from the left can often, or liberals can often be to name the ideology directly, right? So talking about, it's okay to be white, these phrases that we see from white nationalists, right? Labeling that as racist, or labeling, I had an excruciating conversation with someone who I grew up with that has just become a Christian fundamentalist about why their version of really theocracy is at its core anti-democratic and fascist, and having to explain it to them because they couldn't make that connection from their worldview, right? But labeling these things of you're that's racist, that's fascist, right? These responses fail, and this, there was kind of a little bridge in conversation I went through quickly, but this is going back to the earlier concepts of why liberal and some institutional left criticisms fail when they're reading poll numbers, or they're looking at electoral promises not occurring, or even midterms, right? Now this is a little bit different, but it's in the similar vein. Of labeling, how this response fails, not because it's incorrect, oftentimes it's true, but because of how it's received, right? It can be heard just like the introduction to this as institutional discipline. I had an argument years ago when I didn't really understand what was happening about how Joe Rogan just has these cold opens and starts talking, and I'm listening to it like this is chaos. What the hell's even going on? He doesn't even discuss. He doesn't even set the table. Like, what is this garbage? And people saying, "Well, that's exactly what we don't want. We don't want the table. So we want people just to talk. We don't want restrictions. We want people to say what they can, whatever they want without being fact-checked or whatever. We want that freedom of speech. So it feels like enforcement coming from a system that's where it originates from, right? That they already distrust. And essentially at that point, you're just, you know, an NPC or a mouthpiece for it. Even if what they're saying is racist, you know, these are the mental gymnastics that can happen. And because of that, the condemnation itself becomes proof that the idea being condemned is not only potentially correct, but taboo. And once something's perceived as taboo, violating it can, in and of itself, whether you're right or wrong, can feel meaningful. It can feel authentic. And the pushback doesn't discourage that belief. It validates the sense that they don't want us talking about this. It's why, you know, that Piers Morgan interview with Flint, as I feel like, was such a failure, you know, kind of like mocking him for being a virgin supposedly or whatever. Like that type of stance and approach doesn't help anything. And it actually doubles down the convictions of a lot of people that are in this mindset. And so, you know, this is where the left sometimes misreads the situation, right? Moral clarity gets treated as a strategy, as if naming the thing happening, the harm, the potential harm happening is going to stop it. And, you know, that goes way beyond just the concept of not even being able to communicate with people. Forget about, you know, strategizing or something, but just not even understanding how what you're saying is being perceived and how that perception can automatically shut down that conversation. And I think, you know, it goes beyond that. Fact checking, right, gets treated as an intervention, as if correcting errors will dissolve the worldview. But, you know, appeals to democratic norms by other groups get treated as a reassurance, as if people still trust the institutions invoking those norms. But all of those responses assume a baseline of trust that no longer exists for many. And I'm not speaking generally, I'm speaking for the right. So what people are actually seeking isn't accuracy, it's permission. They're seeking permission to assign blame without qualification. They're seeking permission to flip moral language without being corrected. They're seeking permission to disbelieve institutions without factual evidence or being called ignorant and having that mean something. It's permission to accept harm as necessary rather than something that's ethically or morally incorrect. And once that permission is granted, even ideologically, a lot of things that would normally discredit a movement stop working. Contradictions don't really matter as much. Hypocrisy can be explained away. Even repeated losses don't break loyalty. What becomes unbearable is the idea of returning to a system that to them feels rigged, humiliating, and indifferent to their experience. So that's why this little section says that, you know, familiar responses, and I suppose this might be more interpersonal, they don't just fail, they often reinforce the worldview of the other person. They confirm the story already that people are already telling themselves about who has power and who gets silenced. And yes, this absolutely plays into conspiracy theory, but it's not some easy cookie cutter unified belief. You know, it's not one secret meeting or one agreed upon enemy. Instead, it's more what I would call a container. It's a flexible mental structure that can hold many different stories all at once. And evidence no longer corrects mistaken beliefs. It reinforces it now. Data isn't neutral information. It's manipulation. Expertise is not knowledge. It's corruption. It's institutional, and those institutions are corrupted. Ethics aren't moral guidance. They're enforcement tools to silence people. Journalism isn't investigation. It's coordination between elites. In that world, trying to, quote unquote, prove something wrong is very difficult because the act of proof itself is treated as questionable and hostile. So fact-checking, you know, isn't heard as clarification. It's heard as an attack from the very system that's already assumed to be lying. And that's why exposure failures in ways especially liberals, often don't expect, right? If a leader is revealed to be hypocritical or corrupt or grifting, FYI, Truth Social NFTs just dropped, speaking of grifting. But those things don't necessarily, you know, break the deal or discredit, as long as they're seen as directionally accurate in terms of enemies. Their flaws can be reframed, and the container doesn't require any internal consistency. People don't have to agree on who the ultimate villain is. They just have to agree that something powerful is responsible for decline, and that ordinary explanations can't be trusted because whatever that something powerful is manipulating the sources of those explanations. So different groups plug in as different culprits, you know, and this is where sometimes it can be hard on the left when you're analyzing these things, you know, especially academically, and things can become very granular. And, you know, I felt sometimes of the feeling of, is this even worth it? And it is, in short, but it's because it's not just one thing, and misidentifying people in that way, again, just doubles down and reinforces their current belief system that you have no idea what you're talking about. And sometimes it's just Jewish people. Sometimes it's globalists, AKA Jewish people. Sometimes it's globalists, not AKA Jewish people. It could be NGOs or AIPAC, again, you know, Israel. It can be communists or cultural communists, whatever that means, and trans activists. It kind of doesn't matter. And of course they can all be cover too for the same thing as well. But that's why someone doesn't need to be overtly, say, anti-Semitic, right, to operate inside these very similar conspiracy patterns, or even be perceived as racist for using racist language. Many people would reject explicit hatred if you ask them, but they still accept narratives built from the same historical architecture, right? The targets can change, but the structure stays the same. And this, you know, goes to that, that central belief of permission, but it goes back to things I was saying earlier too about cohesion within a group of people who would themselves say they disagree with each other. There is still the ability or funnel for upward movements of ideas and concepts within this chaos that doesn't exist as much on the left, and I'll talk about that. But people don't need to be fully convinced. It's that concept of permission, right? They don't want theory. They want the opposite of theory because theory is institutional. They just need to feel justified in dismissing counter arguments, ignoring repercussions of their actions or accepting coercion, saying, I don't know if it's all true, but something is clearly wrong. It is enough to activate the system, and why it works in that more center audience too, who aren't politically active. That's why, you know, tolerance of harm, I guess, becomes more important than ideological conviction. Someone might not be, you know, fully believe in something like QAnon or you know, see the link between blood libel and those kind of old conspiracies now, or you know, maybe more current civilizational decline narratives, but they may still accept that innocent people could be hurt if it leads to order. I mentioned that order and hierarchy and punishment of enemies or decisive action. And I think that that kind of order, right, the punishments of enemies or decisive action, right, people getting hurt, it kind of goes back to that spectrum of fascism mentioned earlier. You know, decisive action doesn't necessarily mean a rupture or revolution, but it's still on that timeline of acceptance of people getting hurt, right? It's the willingness to accept that real through line. And the core problem is no longer that, you know, the left lacks facts or ethics or arguments. That's not true. As a matter of fact, they hold them. It's that those tools are being used against a structure and no longer recognizes them as legitimate in the first place. So I said a lot, but I think in summary, there are some tools that don't work, right? Labeling first, denunciation, fact checking, institutional reassurances, or pointing out hypocrisy or divergent views. It's that overall idea the right does not need ideological agreement to function as a somewhat coherent political force. So there are different examples, right? First, maybe we could use Israel as an example, right? So on the right, Christian Zionists and white nationalists hold completely opposite views about Israel, and they disagree with each other, and maybe can even be violent towards one another. One side treats it as sacred and essential, the other as the ultimate symbol of elite control, and those views directly contradict each other. But the contradiction does not stop other shared grievances and narratives from spreading and becoming mainstream. Why? Because a coalition is not built around resolving those contradictions. It's not engaging in systemic analysis. It's built around shared feelings and stories about power. The institutions lie, elites betray, quote unquote, the people. Sovereignty has been stolen, and you know, the system is illegitimate. So, and this also kind of helps explain that pause I had much earlier about how this is not horseshoe theory, because that structural analysis on the left can create some similar things, but from very different evidence into very different ends, of course. As long as, you know, on the right, as long as some of these narratives are shared, disagreements doesn't necessarily break the informal coalition that they might argue, you know, exists, or more so that container. And people can argue about details, you know, not about whether the system deserves loyalty, et cetera, but, you know, it kind of shows how maybe something like replacement theory demonstrates the same mechanism, right? Replacement theory starts as the extreme fringe, as an explicit racial conspiracy, stormfront boards, right? And that version still exists, but it doesn't need to be accepted in that form to move upward. What moves upward is the shape of the idea, not the language. The racial framings can get stripped away a little bit and replaced with terms like demographic decline, border chaos, replacement level fertility. These sound more neutral or technical, and even though they carry the same underlying logic, those softened versions then get tied to real events people can see, you know, immigration raids, border enforcement, European elections, debates about the EU. And that makes the narrative feel like simple realism rather than an ideology that's abstract. People don't feel like they're adopting a conspiracy theory or something from stormfront boards. They feel like they're just noticing what's happening in the world. And I feel that many people that, you know, depending on the spectrum of audience, if we're talking about a Tucker Carlson audience or even a Fuentes audience, would probably legitimately feel that way. But crucially, people don't even need to agree on who is responsible. And this is why talking about a pipeline does not mean saying that the right is unified or coordinated. And they would very much argue against that. Right? It means that different actors can contribute to the same overall story while honestly disagreeing with each other. They remain usable inside the same narrative, even when they have conflict. And that's just not necessarily true on the left. And not saying that it should be at all, but it is a difference in the two. And it is a kind of a difference in I wouldn't say worldviews, but in maybe analysis. So from inside the movement, right, from inside the right, disagreement can look like fragmentation. When someone hears pipeline, they imagine, you know, like a hierarchy or maybe a conspiracy. But what's actually happening is looser. It's more durable. Its ideas are gradually softened and reframed and legitimized without anyone fully owning the extreme version. And each person can truthfully say, that's not what I believe, while still pushing the same underlying story. On the left, ideological disagreement usually stops ideas from moving upward because it's structural critique, right? Things like, you know, capitalism or radical environmentalism, they don't have there's no path into executive power without being stripped of their meaning due to their structural natures. Instead of a pipeline, there's more silos. So instead of compatibility across differences, there's friction, to say the least. And that's just an asymmetry, right? On the right, their shared grievance, and that can move upward even when ideologies conflict. On the left, structural critiques tend to fracture as they approach institutions. So it's not excusing the right or denying its internal conflicts. It's explaining why those conflicts don't weaken it the way that many people expect that it should, and why mapping that process is about understanding function as opposed, you know, not flattening the differences between them. Okay. I don't know if what I've said to this point makes sense. It does in my mind, but I think what's emerged on the right, at least in 2025 and with an eye towards 2026, is not a single unified project, but a coalition that's held together by shared assumptions and narrative overlap. And within this coalition, of which they would say doesn't exist, there is a real and consequential split that they're involving post-Trump power grabs in 2026. The division doesn't weaken the movement, though. Even if people are arguing with each other and engaging in power grabs, you know, this could be framed as a fracture in MAGA or the right falling apart. It can actually stabilize it, right? The same failure can be read in two ways at once. Again, for that plausibility wing, it proves the system must be pressured. And for that revolutionary or rupture wing, it proves the system must be overridden. The disagreement is not about whether the system is legitimate. It's about how quickly and how openly to abandon it. And then maybe a final clarification, or at least getting to that point. For all of its adaptability, much of the contemporary right is not generative. Because, and I do want to make this clear, because a lot of this has been kind of understanding the right or translating it and saying why, especially liberals and some left is kind of not hitting the mark. I don't want to confuse that for legitimization at all, right? For its granted adaptability, the contemporary right doesn't really make many things. For as much as they'd like to present themselves as speaking truth to power or being insurgents or this organic force, it's reactionary in a literal sense. Its energy comes from reacting to visible outcomes while rejecting the structural explanations that produce them. And this is where there's maybe like a kind of optimism that's warranted for the left and maybe even progressives. Even if it does not resolve the immediate problem, because the left has historically been the site of idea generation. Labor rights, civil rights, environmentalism, social welfare, human rights frameworks. Even when those ideas are diluted, they're co-opted, they're institutionalized, they're attacked, they're rarely replaced by something that is new in its own right. Right? The right strength lies in mobilizing against change, not really in imagining alternatives. So the danger for the left is not its lack of ideas. It owns those. And that's something I think, you know, I don't want this to be pessimistic. That's something that's positive. It's that I think that maybe where it could go off course a little bit is becoming consumed by defense. And maybe progressives that could leverage institutions, you know, this might pertain to more so, but if the broader left becomes consumed by defense of either institutions or democratic norms or legitimacy itself, or even just, you know, ethical arguments, right? Or just obsessed with tracking and reacting to the right at the expense of continuing to generate meaning, solidarity, and futures that are not defined by opposition, that this could end in a bad way, right? Don't get me wrong, things like anti-fascist research, exposure and monitoring, they need to happen. Fact checking should continue, explicitly so, but reaction to reaction can't be the only mode, or you're chasing your tail, right? When the left allows itself to be defined primarily by resisting the reactionary force, it enters the same trap from the opposite direction, right? It can't outpace this dynamic through tone policing, through comment correction, through competition with memes or debates. Understanding how the right advances despite division is it's not something to try to compete with or copy, right? It's it's a warning not to mistake reactionary momentum for creative power. And the right can escalate, right? It can coerce and it can destabilize, but it's not building something new. Even in the most extreme concepts of speaking of rupture and rebirth, whether it's Christian, theological, or fascist rebirth, it's not really explicitly building something tangibly materially new. Another inversion argument that is often cast against the left that it actually applies to the right. And that distinction, you know, it doesn't solve anything necessarily, but it clarifies what is actually at stake and where the broader left of center still has ground to stand on that the right does not. Fatigue, anger, and burnout on the opposing side are not failures, right? They're predictable outcomes of this structure. One faction escalates, another tries to tamper it down. The opposition is pulled into responding to outputs, provocations, even institutionally into court fights and statements, while the underlying compatibility remains untouched. Or feeling worn down does not mean you're wrong. It means you're operating inside a system designed to exhaust, to provoke, to make you question meaning. Understanding this is not sympathy for reactionary politics. It's not a call to soften any kind of judgment. It's a refusal to keep playing the role that holds that coalition together. That's an overstatement. I wrote that down. It's really refusal to play games on their terms. The struggle now is not really primarily over facts. It's not over ideology. It's not even necessarily over electoral gains, but it's over permission, over what feels justified, what feels inevitable, and who gets to define reality once trust has already collapsed for some people. And you can't counter a movement you have not accurately mapped. You can't disrupt a dynamic if every response supplies in that paradigm the glue between its factions. And you know, this is no roadmap, it's not a manifesto, it's not strategy, it's just more of a situational analysis. These are ideas I jotted down, and it may most probably be incomplete, but without some level of clarity, nothing else has a chance at success. So this was something that I want to put together in retrospective of observations I've made. It's not a paper, it's not a thesis. It's more of broader things and bigger through lines. Again, I'm a little sick. I probably didn't wrap all the loose ends up, but I hope that some of the bigger concepts and the, especially the through line remarks make sense. If not, maybe you can listen to it again at double speed. But anyways, thanks for listening. I'm genuinely interested in your thoughts. So feel free to reach out on social media. You can email me. Check out therightpodcast.org for all the links to all those things. And have a great new year. Here's to a better 2026 for everyone.